65 years ago, the United States implemented the first peacetime draft in its history. The peace, of course, didn't last. By the time World War II ended, some 10 million men had been drafted. Men who opposed war for religious reasons were given an option, and about 50,000 took it. Most went into the military as noncombatants. About 12,000 performed civilian work in the national interest, some dangerous, like parachuting into forest fires, much of it mundane. Nearly all the civilian work camps were run by the peace churches, the Quakers or the Mennonites, but there were government-run camps for the most uncooperative conscientious objectors who opposed church involvement. These 100 or so conscientious objectors were sent to a camp in a town called Germfask in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. NPR's Marcus Rosenbaum reports.
This is a story of a small group of a small group of a small group of men. But except for those who went directly to jail, these were in many ways the men most opposed to war and conscription during World War II. Jane Kopecky first encountered it as a small child. She grew up near Germfask and has lived in the area most of her life. One summer day when she was a little girl, she and her sister were sitting on their steps when some strangers wandered into their yard. Their mother called the girls into the house for their safety, but she let them watch from a window.
And they would pick up a rock and look at it and pass it back and forth, and then they would put it back down, or they would pick up another rock, and they discussed it. And then they would, once in a while, they'd put one into a gunny sack that they had with them.
It was weird. It stuck with her.
And it was just one of those incidents that you remember from very, very early in your life.
As Jane grew up, she began to suspect the men had been from the Germfast camp. And as an adult, a graduate student, and a local history buff, she took on the camp as an assignment, even tracking down some of the men who had been there.
And one of the first men that I called was a man by the name of Dr. Robert Cordell. And he was a geologist. And he said, I used to go around at camp in our spare time, and I would collect rocks from the neighborhood. And he said, I carried those rocks around with me for years. I just disposed of some of them not too long ago.
That was 25 years ago. This year, with her children grown and herself semi-retired, she set out to complete her research. She started talking with more people in her community and looking up more of the men. One of them was Dan Dingman, who now lives in Tampa, Florida.
The Congregational Church, which we belonged to in Palmer, Massachusetts, was not a pacifist church, but accepted us as such. And I like to tell the story that at home, on the table, there was a lamp which was made from a World War I casing, and it had a biblical inscription on it, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall there be war anymore.
Sitting in his garden on a warm spring day, Dan Dingman talked about how and why he got sent to Germfask. He said it started in the middle of the war when he reached draft age. Classified as a conscientious objector, he was sent to a camp in New Hampshire to do conservation work. He quickly ran into problems there. For one thing, all the conchies, as they were called, were asked to contribute $35 a month for their upkeep, and he felt the camp should be paying him for his work, not the other way around. In addition, it was a Quaker camp, and he wasn't a Quaker. Dan Dingman was never a passive pacifist.
And we did not believe in their work and worship, suffer and serve. They said they always gave 200%, and we were 10%ers.
So he was shipped off to a government-run camp in Mancos, Colorado, to build a dam for the Bureau of Reclamation. While assignees weren't asked to pay for their upkeep there, they still received virtually no compensation for their work. So to them, it was still unpaid, forced labor.
Since my objection was to conscription, and since I was now directly dealing with the government, I declined to do anything worthwhile.
He and his fellow campers would follow instructions so literally that it would stymie the work they were supposed to be doing. Told to chop down a tree, they would require instructions for each blow of the axe. Told to put staples in a fence, they would purposely miss the wire. Draft officials were frustrated, to say the least.
Then they decided to build what they called the bad guys' place, Germfask. And that's when we all gathered there.
Germfask was right next to the Seney National Wildlife Refuge, where the conscientious objectors were assigned to work. The camp was much like the other ones, rural and rustic, with Quonset huts alongside a stream. But at Germfask, the assignees were of a different cut. Many of them had been to college. For the most part, they were more intellectually tuned in, and certainly more political, than the average COs at the other camps. Nick Migliorino was also there. He says if the men were incorrigible in the church and government camps, they ended up even more so when they were all put together in Germfask.
You have to slant an axe just right to cut a tree. By twisting it at the last moment, you could bounce off the tree. And we used to applaud each other, and the foreman would be swearing at us and directing us, now don't you twist that axe, and we'd use another little trick.
They also wrote letters. They ginned up publicity. Time magazine reported in February 1945 that Selective Service officials were at their wits' end trying to figure out, as the magazine put it, how to deal with a group of draft-age Americans who have refused to fight, who now decline work, and spend most of their waking hours finding new and more ostentatious ways of thumbing their noses at authority. Not surprisingly, the germfast campers developed a reputation around town, and not always an accurate one. Although there were, and still are, a substantial number of Mennonites in the area, this kind of political action was not really the Mennonite way. Martha Shepherd was a teenager at the time.
They were not very well accepted in the neighborhood or in the community, because what I understood as a young person is that they were the children of rich parents, or parents at least, that didn't want their sons to go in the service. I remember that my dad was a Navy veteran of World War I, and he didn't think too kindly of them, and we weren't to be too friendly with them, because to them, they were cowards.
Campers themselves say they got a mixed reception. Some even dated girls from town. Townspeople who got to know the men seemed to treat them better. Omer Dorn was a youngster at the time.
You had a problem in town, there was somebody at that camp that could fix it. There was locksmiths, there was carpenters, there was plumbers, whatever. And they did come out, you know, in the wintertime and shovel the driveways for the elderly and the paths and that. But there was still that resentment on account of our boys was over there fighting and they weren't.
Occasionally, that resentment turned physical, and the children in particular sometimes took it out on the men from the camp.
The younger ones, of course, got it from the parents, and they'd snowball them or even throw stones at them in the summertime. And these people, for the most part, took it pretty good.
And is there still resentment? He says not really. Besides, with so many Mennonites around, a number of the town's most upstanding citizens were conscientious objectors in one war or another.
It's been, 65 years or so since this happened, and I guess it's time to let it go to rest.
Some of the men who served at Germfast have also tried to put it behind them. Many of them have felt compelled to keep their past in a low profile at least some point in their lives, afraid of the reaction from their employers, colleagues, and friends to the men who refused to fight in the good war. One of the men Jane Kopecky first tracked down had never even told his children. Dan Dingman also had to hide his past from employers, but he says he has never regretted what he did.
I will die saying I didn't kill anybody. And that's something. And I don't mean to besmirch anybody else. It isn't a matter of saying, hey, I've got the answer. What I know is war is not the answer, and I'm not going to be part of it.
Jane Kopecky says her research has changed her mind about the men who refused to go to war.
Before this research started, I was quite closed-minded about COs. My family was all in the service, so it broadened my perspective on life, gave me a deeper understanding.
The draft ended in 1975. But in 1980, President Jimmy Carter reestablished draft boards around the country just in case. Jane Kopecky sits on her local draft board. She says if she ever has to decide between who must go to war and who should not, she's prepared to do so, thanks in no small part to her research into Germfast and the men who were there. Marcus Rosenbaum, NPR News.
And to see photos and hear more from former camp assignee Dan Dingman, you can come to our website, npr.org.